Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
A very short two more days till we know what Jay Powell's thinking. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 30th day of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Hey, spoiler alert, we're going to talk about inflation here at the top of the program. That is Exhibit A in this economy, the first part of this week. The Fed starts a two-day meeting tomorrow, interest rate announcement coming on Wednesday. The central bank keeping its foot on the economic brake, a little bit anyway, as inflation shows. But, slows rather. It's been showing for a long time. It is slowing. But just because inflation is coming down doesn't mean we're not still feeling it. At some point in the past year, every single one of us has walked into a grocery store or tried to rent an apartment or tried to buy any number of things and had that sticker shock, right? And it turns out, this is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, turns out that how high prices are can be a function of where in the country you are. In other words, in some places, the stickers have been more shocking than in others. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab gets us started.
Unless you've been living under a rock for the past couple years, you know that during the pandemic, housing prices exploded.
It was like a market on steroids.
Alexandra Marzek is a real estate broker in Miami, and she says the tight housing market has also put pressure on rents. A one-bedroom in her neighborhood used to go for somewhere between $1,800 and $2,500.
Now you won't find anything for less than $3,500.
Housing is a big factor in measuring inflation. It accounts for a third of the consumer price index. So it's no coincidence that Miami, which has seen a big influx of people and some of the country's biggest increases in cost of shelter, has a higher rate of inflation. While prices are up 6.5% nationally, in Miami, they're up almost 10%. Meanwhile, in San Francisco, where population declined during the pandemic, inflation is less than 5%. Kenan Fikri is research director at the Economic Innovation Group.
Inflation is a measure of an economy running hot, and the economy is running much hotter in certain parts of the country than others.
Migration patterns affect the cost of everything because businesses pay higher rents, and a suddenly bigger population creates more demand, which puts pressure on supply. Justin Wolfers, an economist at the University of Michigan, says this affects the cost of some purchases more than others.
Which is stuff that can travel across state lines usually sells for very similar prices.
AKA goods like food, clothing, and electronics. On the other hand,
stuff that can't, inflation can go in different directions.
That's services, which is exactly where Alexandra Marzek in Miami is seeing the biggest jumps in prices. At work, marketing and photography costs have gone way up. And in her personal life?
My trainer is like, oh, there's a big inflation recession. Now I'm raising my personal training classes.
She went from paying $60 an hour to $100. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, maybe traders are waiting on the Fed. Maybe they're waiting for the Friday jobs report. Maybe they are just cranky. Don't know. But we will have the details when we do the numbers. First Fed meeting of the year starts tomorrow. It's the Federal Open Market Committee, technically. And come Wednesday, At his usual press conference, Chair Jay Powell is going to get a question or 10 about what comes next, big picture, for this economy. Here is what he said about that after the Fed's December meeting.
I don't think anyone knows whether we're going to have a recession or not. And if we do, whether it's going to be a deep one or not. It's not knowable.
That being said, there's a whole industry of people whose job it is to predict the unknowable. They do call it something different, though.
Forecasting.
Jay Bryson's the chief economist at Wells Fargo. Ginger Chambliss is head of research for commercial banking at JPMorgan Chase. And we're going to spend a couple of minutes with them to talk about where their forecasts come from. Because even though they're just predictions, they are affecting the economy right now. Take the layoffs we've seen the past couple of weeks. Some CEOs, on their list of reasons why they're cutting jobs, have said that they are looking at a softening economy and a possible recession.
We are looking for a modest recession to begin in mid-2023.
Our official view is that the U.S. could enter a mild recession later this year.
Which means that if their forecasts come to pass,
we're looking for the unemployment rate to rise to roughly 5% by the end of this year. To put that into perspective, if you go back and you look at the financial crisis, the unemployment rate rose to 10%.
The strength in the labor markets is definitely a factor that we think will mitigate the severity of any downturn.
It wouldn't be the widespread pain that we felt back in 2008, 2009.
Here's how they got there.
It's a mixture of science and a lot more art.
All right, let's start with the science.
There's definitely some modeling that goes on.
Models that predict the probability of a recession using some of the data that we talk about on this program.
What's happening with employment?
3.5% currently, a 50-year low. The January report comes out this Friday.
What's happening with consumer spending?
Fell by 0.2% last month. But wait, there's more.
Consumer sentiment, consumer confidence, business orders, supply chain conditions, inflation.
We learned Friday the core personal consumption expenditures price index. Remember, the Fed's preferred read on inflation is at its lowest levels since October of 2021. The models use all of this data and more, and some economic history as well, to make predictions. All right, forecasts.
But you've got to take them with a little bit of a grain of salt because it's a vast simplification of the U.S. economy, which is really, really complex.
This is a $26 trillion economy made up of hundreds of millions of people making economic decisions every single day. So the art of forecasting?
There's probably more art today than normal.
Because this economy, as I've said before, is just kind of weird right now.
We've seen inflation before, right? We've had supply shocks before, but this is a little bit of a different animal.
We really haven't had this degree of strength or tightness, really, in the labor market.
We've also had the shocks of the pandemic and its ripple effects and the Russian invasion of Ukraine to add even more variables. In general, though, remember this is art and science, and economists know this. You remember that grain of salt that Jay Bryson mentioned earlier?
We all give weathermen a hard time when they say, oh, it's going to be a beautiful day, and you go to the beach, and you get there to the beach, and all of a sudden it starts to rain, and you're saying, what are these knuckleheads thinking, right? Well, kind of the same sort of thing with economists.
Knuckleheads? His term, not mine. There is one thing you should know, though. The actual official declaration of whether we're in a recession and when we get out of one comes to us from the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research. The last recession we had, I'm sure you remember this, the shortest one ever, February to April of 2020. While the second biggest economy in the world takes a bit of a pause for Lunar New Year celebrations and family gatherings, this is a moment, too, to consider what comes next for China. Because after years of zero COVID and now definitely not zero COVID to come, a whole lot depends on how workers and businesses are feeling. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack has been asking around.
A few weeks ago, in anticipation of the Lunar New Year, China's top executives made a rare appearance on the government broadcaster CCTV. First up, the head of beverage giant Wahaha, Zhong Qinghou.
China's economy will recover, and it may even go through a period of high-speed development.
Next up, Cao De Wang, founder of Fuyao Glass. He set up a factory in Ohio that was the subject of the well-received documentary called American Factory. He's just as optimistic.
You ask where my confidence in China's economy comes from? It comes from our sense of responsibility as Chinese people.
In total, 21 executives of the biggest firms were trotted out to trumpet China's economic prospects. But these large companies aren't representative of most Chinese businesses, says Chen Weiming, an entrepreneur in Shanghai.
The zero-COVID policy didn't hit the big firms as hard. Companies that sell everyday products, take the beverage group Wahaha, well, people still need drinkable water, right? But the lockdowns didn't just bring local governments to their knees. They also broke many supply chains.
Including his, for a while. Chen Weiming runs a bath products company and sells mostly to golf courses. Last year, snap lockdowns meant his business couldn't operate for 81 days straight.
I've lost a lot of clients. I couldn't distribute my stuff, so clients turned to other suppliers. And once they've switched, it's hard to get them back.
Global investors are looking to China to help offset some of the economic slowdown in the U.S. and Europe, and they've been more optimistic ever since China dropped its zero-COVID policy in early December. A sentiment not shared initially by one restaurant owner in central Henan province, who posted an online video on TikTok's Chinese sister site Douyin. Using the name Old Salted Fish, he said half his staff caught COVID and he had to fill in himself. Also, his customers got ill or were too afraid to come out. Reopening was supposed to restore freedom, he says, and let us get back to our normal lives. But how is this freedom? There's no one on the streets. China's reopening has been chaotic. Again, entrepreneur Chen Weiming.
It was too sudden. The government didn't provide the medical services needed to cope with so much death and sickness in such a short time.
Ambulance sirens are always in the background these days. Officials say there have been nearly 73,000 COVID-linked deaths from this current wave, which is still an undercount since it only includes people who've died at hospitals. Again, entrepreneur Chen Weiming.
What if a worse COVID variant appears? Will we go back into a lockdown?
For now, the country's chief epidemiologist says the wave of COVID infections may have passed its peak. And there are some signs to support this. That restaurant owner we heard earlier complaining about the chaos, he posted a video update 2 weeks later, showing every table booked. The people who've recovered are back, he boasted. But there's still a lot of uncertainty here. Besides COVID, there's the property slump, U.S. sanctions against China, and tensions over Taiwan, and Russia's war in Ukraine. Again, entrepreneur Chen Weiming.
I feel China's economy is getting more sluggish, so I've moved to a smaller warehouse to reduce my costs and help my business survive longer.
Meanwhile, the top executives on government broadcaster CCTV say they're confident China's economy will blossom again, like flowers in the spring, and ride out the waves. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I went to every lobbyist-sponsored dinner, every event where I could pick up some cheese and crackers.
Legislating on the cheap. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 260 points today, about 0.75%, 33,717. The NASDAQ gave back 227 points. That's nearly 2%, 11,393. The S&P 500 subtracted 52 points, about 1.3%, 4,017. Shares of GE Healthcare rose 2% today after an earnings report, its first since being spun off from the GE mothership. Revenue came in at $4.9 billion. The rest of the week, we'll bring some notable corporate earnings in tech. We'll get numbers from Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, and Meta. We'll hear from Ford, General Motors, Caterpillar, and chipmaker Samsung and Advanced Micro Devices as well. Bond prices fell today. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.54%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. A lot of the supply chain tangles that we were seeing in the depths of the pandemic have cleared up. Not all, but a lot, including computer chips, memory chips in particular. Bloomberg noted today that there's actually a glut of those chips, just as the United States is ramping up its semiconductor capacity. Marketplace's Lila Jamali has an update.
Prices have tanked over the last year because of that glut, and the outlook ahead for the semiconductor industry isn't great, says Willie Shi, professor of management practice at Harvard Business School.
We're seeing inventory corrections in areas that have experienced excesses.
But Shi says that shouldn't remove the urgency of trying to remake the global chip supply chain.
The risk is that people focus on the short term and don't look at the long term problem.
For American policymakers, that long-term problem boils down to promoting U.S. chip manufacturing while protecting national security, according to Jacob Feldgoys of Georgetown's Center for Security and Emerging Technology. The CHIPS Act, which became law this summer, helps subsidize chipmakers in the states with tens of billions of dollars to make them more competitive with China.
That money has already been dispersed by Congress, and the Commerce Department still actually needs to unveil their application process for that money.
Ongoing tensions between China and major chip producer Taiwan have heightened national security concerns. Those have motivated U.S. political leaders to place even more focus on chip policy, according to Chris Miller, author of the recent book Chip War, The Fight for the World's Most Critical Technology. The U.S., the Netherlands, and Japan reportedly just reached a deal that would restrict exports of advanced chip-making machinery to China.
This is very much a strategy of cutting China out of the key tech supply chains that make advanced computing possible.
And Miller says he doesn't expect U.S. policymakers to reverse course anytime soon. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
For as miserable as the worst of the pandemic was for kids cooped up at home, it was boom times for the toy industry. Over the first 2 years of the pandemic, toy sales in this country grew something like 33%. That's according to the NPD Group. Last year, though, sales declined 0.2%, and it's worse than that, way worse, for one of the biggest names in toys, Hasbro. The company behind Monopoly and My Little Pony and Magic the Gathering reports sales in the fourth quarter of last year, holiday time, right, of course, critical, were down 17% from 2021, and that it's going to be laying off about 1,000 people, 15% of its workforce. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes is on the Toys as Economic Indicator beat.
At Shenanigans Toy Shop in Baltimore, owner Flora Stelzer points out a classic Hasbro game.
Twister's popular, although I have to say it's been a little less popular just because of COVID.
Stelzer says a lot of people picked up a game habit during the pandemic, and they're still buying.
People don't want to stint on toys for kids.
Toys are an example of what economists call inelastic goods. People will buy them pretty much no matter what the economy is like. Chris Byrne, an independent toy analyst, says the layoffs at Hasbro reflect the toy industry emerging from a crazy couple of years.
We had an anomalous expansion, and we may be coming back to Earth a little bit.
Byrne says smaller, leaner toy makers have been doing really well, and Hasbro may be moving in that direction.
I think that that's actually a good thing, even though the transition may be a little bit challenging.
Some consumers are trying to be more flexible, too. Outside Shenanigans Toy Shop, I meet customer Jen Adamo.
So I have 5 kids, so our toy consumption is always pretty high.
But these days, she's watching how much she spends on things like gifts.
I think usually when we're going to a birthday party, we'll usually do like $25, $30. So I guess the person will get less if things are more expensive because you can buy fewer things.
Plush toys are doing really well right now because owner Flora Stelzer says everyone likes to have something to hug. In Baltimore, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
A moment here, if you would, for the economics of representative democracy. We're talking state-level representation here, specifically how much or even whether state lawmakers are paid. Turns out, kind of depends on the state. If you live in California or Illinois or Massachusetts, someone's legislating on your behalf year-round and is getting paid a living wage to do it. Members of the New York State Assembly and the New York State Senate draw the highest salaries, $142,000 a year plus per diem. But a lot of more rural and less populous states have what are often called citizen legislatures. They meet just a couple of weeks out of the year. Lawmaker salaries actually can fall below the federal poverty line. Efforts to professionalize those legislatures with higher pay or better benefits don't get a whole lot of traction, though. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more from Santa Fe, New Mexico, home to a volunteer state legislature, by the way.
New Mexico's capital is affectionately known as the Roundhouse. It's the only circular state legislative building in the country. At the center is a big marble rotunda capped with a stained glass skylight.
It really is a beautiful building. It's stunning, right?
Representative Micaela Lara Cadena, a second-term Democrat from South Central New Mexico, is showing me around.
Come this way.
We can't get far without getting flagged down by a lobbyist.
I need to visit with you about the bill you passed years ago on these specialized limited benefits.
Or some constituents who need directions.
Are you all teachers?
Yes.
Good morning. My name is Micaela.
300 miles from her district, Representative Lara Cadena is at home in this building. But she also stands out. For one, she's 40. Most of her colleagues are retirees. She's got tattoos, 2 young kids at home, and a 9-to-5 job.
When I'd heard the seat was going to become available, I knew that it would mean a lot to have a Chicana, a working mom, in a seat of power like this.
But being elected to that seat meant foregoing paid work during her first 60-day legislative session.
I did everything I could to live basic here. I went to every lobbyist-sponsored dinner, every event where I could pick up some cheese and crackers.
She stretched her $165 per diem and accrued credit card debt to make it work. Now she works for a nonprofit that allows her to drop down to half-time during the session. Still, balancing her day job with legislating plus parenting from afar is an emotional and financial drain.
Yeah, I put my family in a compromised situation by deciding to serve in an unpaid body.
Something she says most New Mexicans can't afford to do. But efforts to professionalize this body and other part-time legislatures around the country are an uphill battle.
It has become a framing problem,
says Michael Rocca, a professor of political science at the University of New Mexico.
Politicians have not been able to make this case from their own offices because it seems self-serving.
Trust in government is approaching historic lows, according to the Pew Research Center. And why would we want to provide more resources to politicians we perceive as elitist, out of touch, or even corrupt? But Rocca says that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, since low pay attracts the kind of candidates who can make financial sacrifices.
So what that means is it's usually a wealthier individual, and it's typically those who are retired. And as you might imagine, that introduces all sorts of biases into the system.
A few hundred miles north in Wyoming, Republican State Representative Dan Zwanitzer has watched that bias play out. He and his colleagues make a small base salary. Last year, his shook out to about $22,000.
I mean, in my 19 years, many of my colleagues have had to basically say it's just not worth what it costs to serve.
Leaving a legislature that skews much older and richer and more conservative than the state at large. Meanwhile, Zwanitzer, who's 43, says the legislative workload has increased, and so has lawmaker turnover.
It's a spiral going in the wrong direction that we need to figure out how to turn around.
This year, there are efforts in Wyoming and New Mexico and other citizen legislatures that could eventually raise pay or benefits. But for lawmakers like Representative Lara Cadena, the calculus is changing quickly as politics gets more hostile. Recently, several of her colleagues' homes were shot up in a scheme allegedly orchestrated by a failed legislative candidate.
Certainly in the news of those shootings, I myself have said, like, I have these important bills I'm committed to for 60 days. And at the end of the session, I myself will be evaluating.
Whether the cost of serving has gotten too high. In Santa Fe, I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in keeping with our promise only to mention the guy who now owns Twitter when there is actual news. This qualifies, I think, even though it would ordinarily be categorized as business as usual. Bloomberg reports that Elon Musk, despite auctioning off everything from espresso machines to bird statues, has indeed made the first interest payment on the $13 billion he borrowed to buy the social media site. $300 million, give or take, was the payment due. That is a Bloomberg calculation. Annual debt service for the company now, after Musk loaded it up with debt, about 1.2 billion American simoleons. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Let's call it the number of the week, shall we? A quarter of 1%. I'm just going to say it out loud. We'll know for sure on Wednesday. If you know, you know. Our daily production team includes Olivia Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giang, Maria Honhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.